Skinnier.
WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything that's in the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for April the 14th, 2019. This, as always, is our weekly look at the world of politics and policy, going from City Hall to the State House and all the way on to the White House. So, time to grab that Sunday paper, get that hot cup of coffee, and we'll do our best to get your week off to a good start. Well, I'm just got back from Springfield Friday afternoon after Mayor-elect Lori Lightfoot's visit to the State House. And, you know, it's greener down there, temps a little warmer. Actually, Thursday evening, you could feel humidity in the air before a thunderstorm. And then I come back to this.
And I talked to a very close friend in Cincinnati yesterday who told me it was 81 there a couple days ago.
Yeah, it was in the 70s on Thursday there.
By the way, Rick, I forgot to report one statistic in the newscast.
Sure.
We have a wind chill index.
Oh, I knew we would.
Sorry, I knew. 28 above, not 28 below, but we have a wind chill index going on with the winds northeast at 15, temperatures in the 30s. So that comes out to 28 above.
Yeah, I mean,
have a nice day.
I'm going back to sleep.
I was
that's a good idea.
No, well, just leave the radio on.
Yeah, good
okay.
Point.
But I was out on the storm center patio, and it hasn't started snowing yet. Okay. At least downtown, but it's definitely, you can feel it in the air. This is just a really ugly day.
There's a wet snow and fog and mist being reported at Midway right now.
Okay, good. Is there any weather condition that is not a warning right now for,
no.
For us?
No. And again, a lakeshore flood advisory today that goes into effect until noon. This is for Cook County. So, you know, all along the lakeshore until you get up to Lake County, Illinois, there is a flood advisory along the lakeshore.
Yeah, that wind is significant, by the way. If you
and it was a nice afternoon yesterday.
It was.
I thought it was a very nice afternoon.
In the sun, it was really...
It really was great.
Temperate, and but we all knew this was coming, too.
Yep, yep, yep.
Which I think...
This is not without warning.
Inflated our value of yesterday a little bit.
Exactly, exactly.
While I was... after doing the minimal show prep that I do, obviously, I stopped at the underground hangout, Billy Goat, and I was talking to one of the busboys there, and I said, nobody is going to go to that Cubs game on Sunday. I said, it's, you know, when the game starts, it's going to be forecast temperatures 35 degrees, so that means a wind chill is going to take it to 25. Mm-hmm. And then I looked at the forecast, too, and it showed a 100% chance of snow at 1:20 game time. And I'm really surprised they haven't called the game.
Yeah, I'm monitoring the situation here. The only thing is that the Angels don't come back to town.
That's, yeah.
So usually they'll wait as long as they possibly can to call those games off. Although, with the forecast the way it is, you know, that still might be the case.
But why would you schedule these one-and-done kind of teams this early in the season when you know you've got weather issues going on?
You know, Rick, that's the question I've been asking myself ever since I got involved in baseball. Because the scheduling never really makes a whole lot of sense. Because why would you open up games in March and April in Chicago?
Right.
In Cleveland, in Detroit, with, you know, cities without domes.
Or play night games.
Yeah.
At this time.
But, and the answer that I keep getting is that it's schedule imbalance. Because if you put, say, the White Sox and the Cubs on the road for the first 2 weeks, their home opener is late, and then they get home games at the end of the season when maybe St. Louis and maybe Detroit don't. So they try to make it so that you can play X amount of road games, X amount of home games early, so that there's no disparity later when a team may be going for a division and they're getting all these home games because they had to open up on the road.
And wasn't it last season that there were numerous games through the Midwest and the East that were canceled?
Well, the White Sox had four out of five.
To make up. They would have to make them up, you know, at some point.
Yeah, I mean, you remember almost a year ago at this time, the White Sox were in Kansas City. They got frozen out of a Sunday game.
That's right.
They played a Monday game in Minneapolis, and then the Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday games were all banged because of 8 inches of snow.
8 inches of snow, right. Yeah.
So it doesn't make a lot of sense. But, you know, you can't give the advantage early in the season, too, to all these warm-weather teams and also all the teams that play in domes. And you can't play the season starting any later with the way that the schedule is configured, 162 games, without playing a World Series game, you know, in November.
No, I get that. Yeah. But it's like, it, to me, the fact that you have the Angels are here in Chicago.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Why aren't we there now?
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, it maybe play this series a little bit later on because that's what happens now. Because when they went to the unbalanced schedule many, many years ago, you know, the teams from the, if you're in the Central Division like the Cubs and the White Sox are, if you play the, you know, the East and the West, you're only seeing these teams, you know, one time at your place and one time at their place. As opposed to the divisions games when you're visiting a city three times and they're coming to you three or two times, depending on how many teams are in your division. You know, back in the early days that I can remember, it was always kind of an equal situation. You'd play the Mets twice in New York, and they'd come here twice. How much better would that be to be able to say, okay, well, we don't have to sit here and wait all day because, yeah, the Mets are coming back.
Right, right. I mean, we don't have to have the clock ticking on whether you get
correct
the game called or not.
Right. So, you know, I'll petition to be the commissioner of baseball soon. And when I am commissioner, I sound like John Williams here when I'm king, right?
Yes, right.
When I am commissioner, I will reinstitute the balanced schedule.
I'm all right.
Yeah.
I'm for you.
I'm going for
you.
Yeah.
Thank you, by the way, in the sportscast for
that was just for you
mentioning
mm-hmm.
The UMD, University of Minnesota Duluth. How about it? I've got my Bulldog cap on, repping Northern Minnesota, where my dad's from, and back-to-back NCAA Frozen Four championships. And this was the third consecutive year they were in the championship game.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty impressive. Their goaltender has 7 shutouts now.
Yes.
It's pretty amazing.
I mean, UMass, that it's a relatively new program,
mm-hmm.
and it wasn't that long ago. They had a 5-win season, which tells you how far that program has come. But obviously, 3-0 shutout, the Bulldogs, they had been there before, mm-hmm. and that I think that was kind of the difference. I think UMass only got 18 shots on goal for the entire game. But yeah, great victory for Minnesota Duluth, and that's okay. Good, we're all going to do the Northern Minnesota accents, okay? Yes, no, but just a great victory for them and for all of my relatives up north. That's just fantastic, and even got a text from my buddy Matt, who was at the tournament, and said just got into 720 territory on his way back. So thanks for listening. I didn't see, despite the warnings,
mm-hmm.
I did not see the hordes of Star Wars conventioners.
Yeah, I didn't see many either.
I was told about some of them that were, you know, walking down in the South Loop kind of thing, but
I didn't see any either, come to think of it.
But you know, they were talking like 70,000 people and all that kind of, and I have to admit, after the first 3 movies, I kind of tuned out of it, so I'm not really into the whole saga or
I can
whatever.
Do you one better.
Yeah,
I saw the first one.
Yeah, and that was it.
And that's the story of my Star Wars viewing.
Well, I do remember when they re-released that first one,
mm-hmm.
I took my daughters, who were then young, to go see it at the theater. And their response was how cheesy all the graphics looked.
Oh, man.
How far the technology has come.
Uh-huh.
But at the same time, that was pretty much the movie that started a lot of the, got the ball rolling on the special effects.
Yeah, Lucasfilm. And
Lucasfilm, yeah.
That became the primo technology division. But so I guess they're around, these folks, but I haven't seen any lightsabers going off or anything like that. You mentioned, Andy, the Masters, too, which I don't know that they've – I don't recall on a final Sunday the playing threesomes.
Yeah, this is rare. I believe this is the first time in the final round that they're also utilizing both the first and the 10th tee. They're expecting weather there at about 2 o'clock our time. So they moved the tee times up. There's golfers out on the course right now. Tiger Woods and the leaders group will go out in about about an hour or so from right now. And their hope is to get the round in its completion today. And they want to account for it in case there's a playoff. They want to get it all done today so they don't have to come back tomorrow.
Well, I mean, I used to play golf a lot, and primarily when I was down in Springfield, because you had like 10-degree warmer temperatures mm-hmm. down there. Golf was a little cheaper down there, too, I have to say. But I rarely watch golf tournaments now, but this is almost like a must-watch kind of tournament, because of what it represents of the history to it, the fact that, you know, they run out of green spray paint down there in Augusta to make the place just look so beautiful. Uh-huh. And it tells you it's spring, it's Easter. And I think, you know, hopefully there'll be a little bit of sunshine there when you turn on the TV, so it reminds you what is going to come ahead on a day like today.
Yeah, and of course, today a little extra significance to those that are just casual golf fans because Tiger Woods is lurking.
Yes, he is.
He'll be wearing the Sunday red. You got to believe that.
Two shots back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I mean, that's all you need to watch right there. So very, very exciting things to come. Well, Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news. Andy has the latest sports. Producer Ro is in for Kasara today, and she's fielding your calls. We're at 312-981-7200. You can text us at 312-981-7200. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're on Twitter @SundaySpin. And engineer Bob is thinking about bringing the newsroom Zamboni out of storage today. Remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNradio.com. You can also get our podcast at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio, overlooking a kind of dreary Sunday morning with the rain now, wind, and the snow yet to come downtown. Time for our weekly spin through national politics and another wild week around the Trump White House. Let's start with the arrest of Julian Assange, the head of WikiLeaks, who sits in a London jail after Ecuador stopped giving him asylum in its embassy in London. WikiLeaks and disclosures of emails hindering Hillary Clinton were a big part of the Trump 2016 campaign. And just the other day, the president was asked if he still loved WikiLeaks.
Do you still love WikiLeaks?
I know nothing about WikiLeaks. It's not my thing. And I know there is something having to do with Julian Assange. I've been seeing what's happened with Assange, and that will be a determination, I would imagine, mostly by the Attorney General.
And the president went on to say that he didn't believe that WikiLeaks was a big deal in his life. So the president knows nothing about WikiLeaks. Well, here's a brief compilation of what he had to say during the campaign about WikiLeaks. So the president says he doesn't know WikiLeaks. We also are still awaiting the Mueller report from Attorney General William Barr. some of Mueller's special counsel staff still isn't happy with the way Barr characterized the report. Appearing at a Capitol Hill hearing, Barr was asked by New York Democratic Representative Nita Lowley if the White House had seen the Mueller report. Barr wouldn't say.
Did the White House see the report before you released your summarizing letter? Has the White House seen it since then? Have they been briefed on the contents beyond what was in your summarizing letter to the Judiciary Committee?
I've said what I'm going to say about the report today. I've issued three letters about it, and I was willing to discuss the historic information of how the report came to me and my decision on Sunday. But I've already laid out the process that is going forward to release these reports, hopefully within a week. And I'm not going to say anything more about it until the report is out and everyone has a chance to look at it.
That's Attorney General William Barr. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's The Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning and welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio on the 18th floor overlooking the Chicago River and a murky, angry lake at the waves kind of crashing up over the outer seawall out there. Joining me now on the phone is Democratic State Representative Michael Zalewski from Riverside. He is one of the major architects as the state looks to expand its gaming options to include sports gambling. Representative, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
It's good to be on, Rick. Good morning to you.
You know, as I look outside and look at the lake, it's like not that Springfield can be the most attractive place in the world, but it's certainly a heck of a lot warmer than what we're getting today.
It was nice down there this week, but it is good to be home for 2 weeks, so I'm happy to be here.
Yes. The legislature on its two-week break before the big crunch, launching May and the final scheduled month of the Illinois General Assembly. So why don't you give us an overview of where things stand from your perspective as the state considers legalizing sports wagering and the fact that there is a revenue component that Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker has included in his budget to come from sports gambling.
Yeah, we had a great hearing on March 28th with four different versions of a sports betting bill. They each had their own unique components to them. But in all reality, you have an option of having the bricks and mortar casinos and the horse racing tracks and the OTBs to have a sports book within them, along with what we're calling an online skin, which is a partnership with a mobile platform to offer it on your phone or your laptop or your device. We also included ideas from the leagues and the teams themselves. They want a place at the table to engage in sports betting and to benefit from it. And then we heard from the we heard a concept related to the Illinois lottery. So we heard from those four sort of silos, including four sponsors, and we're digesting it. We've been digesting it now for about 2 weeks. We're probably going to have another hearing on April 25th in Chicago to further the conversation. But I think we're in a good place. I think we're going to continue to put pen to paper and have a bill that's ready to file in the near future.
Well, I know, you know, it seemed like the idea of sports gambling would be something that would, frankly, bring what are often disparate interests in the issue of expanded gambling to the table, as long as, you know, everybody got a cut of it. But I'm wondering, to me, the idea of, you know, having specific sports, physical sports books at, you know, the tracks or the casinos is fine, but I am glad you mentioned it, because I think most people are kind of looking at the idea of wanting to have that mobile platform.
I think in any modern sort of environment, if you don't consider a mobile platform as part of a next wave of doing something like this, then you're probably being a little short-sighted. we have to be careful about it. We have to have strong consumer protections and age verifications. We have to debate whether how you put money into the account, whether you have to be physically there in person to initially put the money in the account and set up the account. The governor has relied on this in his fiscal year 20 budget. B, we want the state to benefit from it as much as it possibly can. So mobile will play a big role, and I think whatever we end up doing, I think will play a big role in whatever we end up doing, and it should. And I think we'll be able to offer the consumer what they want in terms of the product while making it safe and transparent.
You mentioned about the leagues had come to the table, and of course, that's with the Supreme Court ruling that allowed for sports wagering, the leagues have taken a more active role, and some of them you see even partnering with various firms or casinos or those kinds of things. And I know that they want a piece of the cut. They call it an integrity fee. Do they deserve a cut?
They would make the argument, and they did make the argument at that hearing and with Representative Andre Tappetti, who sort of led this component of the conversation, that you cannot have this conversation without them being a stakeholder at the table. Now, to your point about the integrity fee or the royalty fee, it's very controversial. It's something that everybody at a national level really tries to dismiss as something that's not fair because Las Vegas has done this for 40 years without the need for it. What I've consistently said is, in Illinois, I can only look at Illinois, and in Illinois we have four large ownership groups related to the professional sports teams, the Ricketts, the Wirtzes, the Reinsdorf family, and the McCaskies. Within those four ownership groups, we have individuals who invested a ton of political and monetary capital in their teams. You know, the Ricketts family has basically rebuilt Wrigley Field. The Wirtz and the Reinsdorf family put a ton of money in the Near West Side. So I don't think it's wise to sit there and tell them, you know what, we're going to do this without you. We're going to do this over your objection. We've invited them into the conversation. We've had pretty productive dialogue. I think members have responded positively to including them. And oh, by the way, Rick, they're not sports owner billionaires and millionaires for a reason. They know how to sort of work within the confines of the political structure. So
right.
They're savvy individuals who want to be a part of this conversation. So we're going to welcome into the conversation. We're going to try to accommodate, you know, what they'd like to see out of this. But you can't promise anything in a piece of legislation. But I think the process so far has been really good.
With Mayor Lightfoot down in Springfield at the end of last week, there was once again the question of, you know, a casino for Chicago, and is this going to be only a sports wagering kind of effort, or are we also opening the entire issue of expanded gaming, including the possibility of casinos in Chicago and Rockford and elsewhere?
Well, Representative Bob Rita in our caucus and Senator Terry Lincoln in the Senate Dems, along with Senator Munoz, have they've been involved in these conversations to the extent that they are leading the conversation on bricks and mortar casinos and the VGT question. And I would say this: I think the governor introduced it as a separate proposal. He really wants the sports wagering piece to go to the general revenue fund. So we've tried to treat it as best we can as a separate proposal. You raise a really good point. It's hard to do that, especially with an incoming mayor who has a desperate need for revenue and who's looking to Springfield to help her as she begins her new term. It'd be unwise to say that all of these aren't interrelated, but I also think that we're doing our best to accommodate the governor's request, which is focus on sports wagering as a component piece. And, you know, I know Representative Rita and Senator Link continue to work on casino expansion and gaming expansion as a component piece to try to work out whatever we can do to bring resolution to a lot of different struggling issues the state's facing at the end of May.
Well, yeah, and end of May always is crunch time and a lot of still major unresolved issues. But do you think in the end we will have a sports wagering bill go to the governor?
I, I'm optimistic that we've done a lot of good work on this issue. I never say things are going to happen or not happen, especially in Springfield, especially at the end of May. All you can do is put your best foot forward and try your best. I will say this. I think we have a lot to do at the end of May. I think there's going to be more done at the end of May than we've seen around in Springfield in a very long time. So any big issue that has to get done is going to get done in the context of the fiscal crisis the state's facing. And that puts a lot of pressure on members to walk out of Springfield having tried to build a bridge to the governor's vision. And in that context, I think you have a pretty decent shot of getting something done.
We're going to talk about some of those issues up ahead. We're speaking with Michael Zalewski, Democratic State Representative from Riverside. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio. Joining me on the phone, Michael Zalewski, Democratic State Representative from Riverside. Let's talk about kind of the cataclysmic confluence of issues that are going to be facing you and your colleagues down in Springfield for the scheduled wrap-up on May 31st. One is the governor's push for putting that constitutional amendment on the ballot for a graduated to that would allow for a graduated rate income tax, changing the Constitution, asking voters on the 2020 election to ask voters if they would support a change to eliminate the mandated flat rate income tax in the state. And we're seeing the TV ads already, and I think we're going to see millions and millions of dollars more on that. And Representative, I've always thought it's an easier pass in the Senate, takes 3/5 vote to put this on the ballot. Easier pass in the Senate than the House. Takes 71 votes. There's 74 Democrats. Obviously, Democrats would like to have some Republicans join them in this. Does not look like that's going to happen specifically in the House. And, you know, I know it's, quote, still early in the process, but I think it's going to be a difficult pass in the House.
I think the amendment itself won't be as difficult a task as the rates bill. The amendment effectively says, look, the people will be able to go to their polling place in November of 2020 and tell the state that they'd like to change the Constitution to remove the flat tax requirement. I think most of our members, especially in our targeted districts, ran on the idea that our tax system was outdated and favored disproportionately was favored against the middle class. So I think the amendment in the House have garnered enough a lot of support of my colleagues. I think the rates bill, which is what the Governor Pritzker has said he needs to beat back against the bad faith arguments that the opponents are going to put on this. That's where we're working really closely with our colleagues to try to educate them, make them feel comfortable, make them feel like this is really a good idea, and we're making good progress. There's a lot of published reports this week about roll calls and people getting cold feet. I don't get that vibe at all. I do think members want to feel really comfortable about this. We're trying to get their comfort level in a good place, and we're progressing toward a joint effort with the Senate.
Well, is now the rates that the governor proposed, is that the final say here? Because we always hear talk too that, you know, there are negotiations going on.
There are negotiations going on. The rates bill can actually consist of the rates themselves, along with pieces related to child care credit and property tax relief. So there's some fungible parts in there that we're working on with the Senate to try to, again, assuage uncomfortable members. Rick, this ties directly into the conversation we had a couple years ago on an evidence-based model, pouring more money into our education system that's been underfunded for several years. So we've got to get a fair tax in Illinois to adequately fund the evidence-based model, which will adequately fund education, which will make inevitably all of our problems less pressing in the short term and solve them in the long term. So If we hammer that conversation home, I think we're going to do good things for our members and good things for our constituents.
One of the questions in throughout this, even before since he unveiled his budget and obviously this would not affect the current fiscal year's or upcoming fiscal year's budget because it wouldn't even get to the voters till 2020, but whether, given the magnitude of the state's fiscal problems, whether the rates as proposed and the $3 billion generated, whether that's enough. Really, is that enough? I mean, if you want to provide substantial property tax relief, you know, do more than just begin the effort to reduce the property tax burden, because primarily that's due to the way we fund schools in the state. I mean, does this go far enough?
I think to build a bridge to the governor's vision of what he wants to see the state's budget look like, it certainly does enough. You know, on top of that, to your question earlier about roll calls we're just starting the conversation on a tax bill. It is incredibly, incredibly difficult to pass tax-related items in Springfield on a level like this. So,
well, and that's what I mean is you get very few opportunities to do this, and so, you know, politically. Take advantage of that opportunity, and get what you need, because you don't get a second bite at the apple.
Sure, you're absolutely right. I think the governor has scaled it to the point where he feels like it will do what he needs. It thinks it's necessary to do to put us into the next phase of state finance, while at the same time getting enough votes to pass it. You have to convince members that 97% of their constituents will see no change in their tax bill or tax relief. You have to convince them that this is going to solve the problems of the state, which, quite frankly, over the last 8 to 10 years, we haven't done a good job of earning their good faith, the voters' good faith on state finances. You have to also make sure that it's not a blank check to state government to raise taxes whenever they'd like. Like, these rates, I think, were comprised in such a way that it really puts us in the narrow bandwidth of what people will feel is a good faith change to the way that we take their money. So I think we're in the middle of that bandwidth right now. We have a little bit of work to do on convincing people that there's enough property tax relief in this. We have a little bit of work to do to convince people that if they're a small business owner or a young family that's thinking about staying in Illinois or staying in Chicago versus going to another state, that this is a place they want to be, because we have great institutions of higher ed. We have great places to get a job. We've got to really strike the right balance, and I think we're on the right path to do that.
Where does a capital bill fall into this, an infrastructure bill?
We need a capital bill desperately. We haven't had one in 10 years. I think as you mentioned earlier, our overall Springfield agenda right now is chock full. There are being conversations related to capital, I think, on how to fund it appropriately. I know people are very wary of a gas tax increase. But what I will say is, if it's not a gas tax increase, what we can't do is just assume it's a short-term, small revenue bump that we're going to be able to sell $30 billion in capital bonds for. Because the last time we did this, we did not do it the right way. We assumed that the city of Chicago would opt into BGT. They did not. And it blew a big hole in our capital budget. And as a result, the list of capital needs hasn't really changed all that much in 10 years. We did a few things from that bill, but we didn't do nearly enough. So the funding aspect of it is crucial. We have to get it right this time. And I think there's conversations had in Springfield about the exact right way to do that.
Well, and I mean, obviously a gas tax would be a component.
I think a gas tax is the most stable, sophisticated way to make sure that our horizontal roads and bridges needs are taken care of. It's directly tangential to the needs of the communities that would benefit from it. When you hear stakeholders say, I want capital, I want my road fixed, I want my pothole fixed, I want my bridge taken care of, and then you ask them, well, how would you pay for it? If they don't say, well, you know what, I stand ready to support the General Assembly, if they make the hard decision to raise revenue to support a capital bill, then it's not a good faith conversation. So we're asking stakeholders to help us do what is tough and what is necessary to get to a place where we can start getting the state's infrastructure back on not even a good path, a safe path. We're really struggling in terms of how safe our roads and bridges are. So
it's always fun to watch those roll calls to see who votes to take the projects but doesn't vote to fund the effort.
I will tell you this: there have been numbers of conversation members who feel this year like if you don't support the revenue, and this doesn't just go for capital; it goes for the DRF piece too. If you don't support the revenue to go with your idea, then you shouldn't have an opportunity to say that your idea should prevail. I think that there's a sentiment out there that there's going to have to be enough tough votes necessary that you should put your political capital online and support the tough things necessary to derive the benefit of what's going to come if we do get the state on the right path. I think that's a sentiment that is going to be pretty strong this session. I really do.
That's Democratic State Representative Mike Zalewski from Riverside. Representative, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Rick, I'm going to go watch the Masters. Have a really good Sunday.
You too. We'll be back with more right after this.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. Immigration remains a major issue for the president. He acknowledged his administration has looked at shipping migrants in the country who are here illegally to so-called sanctuary cities, and Chicago is one, to try to stir up crime and move Democrats on the issue. Trump also dumped his Homeland Security Secretary and others because he says they weren't tough enough. But he says he's not cleaning house.
Well, I never said I'm cleaning house. I don't know who came up with that expression. We have a lot of great people over there. We have bad laws. We have a judge that just ruled incredibly that he doesn't want people staying in Mexico. Figure that one out. Nobody can believe these decisions we're getting from the Ninth Circuit. It's a disgrace. And so we're fighting the bad laws, the bad things that are coming out of Congress. You have a Democrat Congress that's obstructing. You talk about obstruction, the greatest obstruction anyone's ever seen. All they have to do is spend 20 minutes and they can fix this whole problem. We have the worst laws of any country anywhere in the world.
Now, as for the border, Trump has said more U.S. military may be called in, but he cautioned that the U.S. military really can't act tough against migrants like those, like military from another country could act.
And if you don't have a wall, and they all agree, you don't need drones. Drones, wonderful to have drones. But you don't have a wall, it's never going to happen. It's all never going to happen. Your border people are fantastic, Border Patrol. Your military, fantastic. I'm going to have to call up more military. But our military, don't forget, can't act like a military would act. Because if they got a little rough, everybody would go crazy. So our military can't act like they would normally act or like, let's say, another military from another country would act.
And that's the President of the United States. We're going to bring things more locally now, and joining me now here in the Allstate Skyline studio is Robert Rader, president of the Chicago Federation of Labor. Bob, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks, Rick. You don't want to talk about Trump with me? I'd love talking about Donald Trump.
I'm sure you would, but I mean, there's a lot of things to talk about closer to home that you guys are part of.
Really? I'm just so captivated by the view up here that I forgot everything that's going on in the city right now.
You know, there's probably, this could be like a safe haven place. There's probably a lot of people that like to come up here and not worry about the problems in the city of Chicago.
Sitting here with a Tribune reporter in the WGN studios, and this is my happy place.
You're getting a nosebleed.
Hey, this is great. Thank you for having me on.
No, thank you. Thank you. And I appreciate you coming on.
Yeah.
I want to start with real local and the issue of workplace scheduling. And, you know, this has been talked about and debated and massaged, whatever, for over a year. And here it's supposed to have come to a vote in the council last week, and due to lack of a quorum, it doesn't go anywhere. And now it's going to be an issue before the new city council. Could you just start out, one, just kind of lay out the issue from your perspective and where you see things going now?
Well, I think this Fair Work Week ordinance that was moving before city council is going to be an incredible opportunity to really be one of the most important safeguards, I think, that we've been able to, you know, push and hopefully acquire for the workforce here in Chicago in recent memory. You know, it's on the heels of raising the minimum wage and, you know, passing this earned sick leave ordinance that we did a few years ago. And this I see is like, you know, the triple crown, as it were, of workforce protections. So, you know, it came before the city council finally, or not the city council, but the workforce committee, and it was amazing. It was amazing. Only in Chicago can you build to such a crescendo, and then all of a sudden not have enough aldermen to keep the committee meeting going. It's shocking how everyone just disappears on you.
So what does this do?
So
in the version that you would like to see?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're going to go into a new city council, Rick, that I think is going to be even more progressive than the last city council. So I'm not sure which version we're talking about, because I think that we're going to probably be looking at a version that's closer to what our original version was.
So let's start there.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, here's where we're starting out. If you looked at the original version, this was going to be a very broad law that helped create predictive scheduling for the workers here in Chicago. Things like 14 days advance notice of your schedule, minimums on, you know, time off between shifts, predictability pay, where if the employer makes a change to your shift within the window, that you would get a one hour differential. So you can so that way it holds everyone accountable to scheduling. Now, if you look at take my mom for instance, she worked in healthcare her entire career, and I have a lot of family that have worked in healthcare. If you look at the scheduling chaos people have to deal with in healthcare, and then you hear the healthcare employers come back and say, well, we have a lot, you know, people work here at our company forever. I'm like, well, yeah, because if they leave your hospital and go down the street, it doesn't get any better, right? People have grown accustomed to this chaotic scheduling, oppressive scheduling, and it's not just one industry that this is a problem with, it's several. So we're going to be looking at, we spent a lot of time, I personally spent a lot of time the last couple of weeks talking through this issue with people on the employer side and also people on my side to come up with a compromise ordinance that we had ready to go on Monday, right? I think it was respectful. Good public policy gets made when everybody gets to the table, right? But dynamics change, right? So we're talking about now going into the next city council, starting in May. I'm hoping we're going to have something on fair scheduling done by the end of summer, beginning of fall.
And again, going back to more towards the original proposal than what you had presented on Monday.
Well, I think so, because one, and it's, you know, to get the triple crown here of workplace protections, I don't think it's going to depend even so much on us. This new city council, these are people who not only ran on issues like Fair Work Week and workforce protections, they live it and breathe it, right? We're going to have to hit that reset button and go back to the original ordinance, because I think that's where the aldermen may be at.
Even if you don't, that's where they're coming from.
It's great. It's amazing. You know, if you look at this next city council, you're going to have a lot of folks who are progressive. You know, they talk about the quote unquote democratic socialists who are going to be in there. And, you know, I have a lot of fondness and admiration for all these folks. It's going to be an interesting day in Chicago.
So you mentioned this workplace scheduling would be the triple crown. Is there a fourth component? What's next?
Well,
as far as city ordinance,
you know, we're going to have to take a look at that. You know, there's, if you look at Star Wars, Rick, there was the first trilogy, the second
Star
trilogy,
Wars.
And the third trilogy.
Yeah, except if the first three I watched. After that, I gave up.
I think after this, we have two more trilogies to go, and then we can do like what Disney said here the other day. We'll take a pause, and then we'll get into the next trilogy.
Labor law as Star Wars. There you go.
Sunday morning. Hey, but seriously, I'm very excited about this. And you know, I talk about this new city council and the opportunities it presents. Here's why people are getting elected here in Chicago to put these types of policies forward. This is where the public's at. Let's make no mistake about it. And I'm not just talking about one segment of the city. These policies, workplace protections, they are some of the best polling issues that you're going to have in any campaign, because it cuts right to people's pocketbook and their quality of life. Scheduling is a huge issue for low-wage workers, but people that are middle-income and higher-income people, they deal with this nonsense too. Everyone can wrap their head around the idea of predictability in their schedule, and when they see provisions around predictability pay and having the ability to have a window of time to get their schedules set, they're like, absolutely, because it's cuts the fundamental issue of fairness. And before we pivot out of this, I really just want to also say that I don't want to make it seem like what happened on Monday with this ordinance getting kicked was in any way a reflection on some of the people that we did negotiate with from the employer community that wanted to really look at this issue and come to resolution on it. There were several people from the employer community that wanted to get this thing done. And there was even a push, you know, after the committee failed to come up with quorum, to figure out a way to still get this thing to come
before this full council.
Right. And I also have to say that I would have been very happy to get this done before this council, because we would have the opportunity to come back and
amend it,
but we'll just get the whole thing done next time, and we'll have less amendments going in to the next 2 years, right?
We're speaking to Robert Reeder. He's the president of the Chicago Federation of Labor. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Skyline studio with Robert Reeder, president of the Chicago Federation of Labor. We were talking about the workplace scheduling ordinance in the city of Chicago, but I want to broaden the discussion out to labor issues going on down in Springfield. The governor last week signing legislation to ban local right to work zones. That was an issue that was pushed by previous Republican Governor Bruce Rauner, Governor Pritzker signing that ban. And there's always been a question of legality regarding that anyway, of whether local communities or counties could set up zones that were exempt from collective bargaining type agreements and requirements.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to say right off the bat, anytime you have this discussion, is right to work does not mean right to work. Right to work's a law that impacts a union's ability to represent its members, because it takes a shot at labor through equity and requires the union to represent people who don't either pay dues or pay a user fee, essentially, for the representation they receive. It's completely, right to work is completely an anti-Republican issue. So if there's any Republicans out there that are big right to work proponents, complete phonies.
Well, the governor, previous governor, was one.
Well, I mean, do I have to say that he was a complete phony? Because
no.
It had nothing to do with, if he was standing on his Republican principles, he wouldn't have moved and been so virulently supportive of a of right to work, because it's completely goes against the rules and of the ability of freedom of to contract. But this governor J.B. Pritzker has been amazing at giving workers a voice and protecting workers. I mean, this guy's only been in office for 4 months, going on 5 months, and he's just doing such a great job of getting to the issues that people are actually concerned about, right? We raised the minimum wage. For people in labor, we're taking a strike against these right-to-work zones, something that was, when it was, you're right, the legality of it has been questionable from day one, but now that the state has weighed in, I think it becomes clear that you can't have these right to work zones here in Illinois.
With some of the concerns of labor and passage of a pro labor agenda so far in Springfield, but one of the big things, and I was talking about this in the previous segment with Representative Zalewski, was the issue of a capital bill, which I know is something that labor would love to see, and it's a jobs bill is what it is, but you know, it's part of all of the noise at the end of session. How do you fund it? How do you make it work? Where are we on that?
Well, I would say that the capital bill isn't just a jobs bill. It is, and it's huge and it's important, but the capital bill is also a bill for the everyday people of Illinois. So there's a lot of folks who live and work on the I-80 corridor, right? That's for some, that's the dividing line between north and south,
upstate and downstate.
Yeah, right. But there's a bridge. I don't know if you're familiar with this bridge that goes over the Des Plaines River through Joliet. And it's one of the lowest rated bridges, I think, in the country, definitely in the state. And the safety of this bridge has been scrutinized and looked at to the point where, you know, people like me and my family, we figure out ways to go around this bridge all the time. I have a lot of family who live in that south suburban I-80 corridor. When you talk about roads and bridges, we want to build them. We want to build them like crazy. But the people we represent also drive on these roads and bridges? And God help us if we don't have, you know, if hopefully we don't have a disaster like they've had in other states with bridges. But it also is causes huge traffic problems, right? When you have state highways that are littered with potholes that are constantly undergoing patchwork, which is way more disruptive than taking down a lane and just redoing one lane at a time and getting a highway up and going. It has an incredible impact to the quality of life for people who live here in Illinois.
So where are we on this in Springfield?
I mean, I think the urgency is there. I think people are feeling it, but we have to reconcile, I think, down in Springfield, how we're going to fund both the horizontal infrastructure and also the vertical infrastructure, which is as important and has been neglected probably even longer than roads and bridges to some extent.
And when you say that, you're talking about buildings and schools and university, public university projects, those kinds of things that are non-transportation related.
Right, absolutely. So you're looking at our state universities, you're looking at modernizing these buildings, you're looking at providing a safe environment, not only for the people who work in those buildings and facilities, but also for the people who are served by those buildings and facilities, which are the citizens of the state of Illinois.
That's Robert Reeder. He's the president of the Chicago Federation of Labor. Thank you so much for coming in studio this morning.
Thanks, Rick. It was a lot of fun.
We'll be back with more right after this.
Now, the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Attorney General William Barr accused the FBI of spying on President Trump's 2016 campaign. That drew a sharp rebuke from Democratic Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, who at some times has allied himself with Trump.
To come from our Attorney General, I know he tried to backtrack that and walk that back. The only spying that I saw was Russia spying. And Russia was trying to spy on anybody and everybody they could to get more involved in our process, to have some influence of what direction it would go. There is no doubt. Now, whoever they're talking about the spying, I can assure you we didn't see the political parties spying on each other from that standpoint to where it was. We saw basically this whole Julian Assange. We saw all of that. We saw Russia with no, all the evidence we had, and no doubt that Russia was doing everything they could on social media and every other.
That's Democratic Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia. Joining me now here in the Allstate Skyline studio, high above the snow that's falling outside, is Michael Jacobson. He is the CEO of the Illinois Hotels and Lodging Association. Mike, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me. Happy Masters Sunday.
Yes. I mean, that's what I was saying, is like, you got to watch the Masters now because of how bad it looks outside, just as a reminder that there are better days ahead.
Hopefully. Fingers crossed. It's a nice day to spend the day inside and watch on TV.
Yes, it is. With a fireplace burning.
Amen.
You know, there you go. I wanted to have Mike on because we had just heard from Bob Reeder from the Chicago Federation of Labor and their position on this issue of workplace scheduling. And I wanted to get kind of an employer's take here as well, so that we can kind of keep things a little bit balanced. But I'm curious what your thoughts are, where he points to a new, more progressive city council coming in, and that while there had been negotiations going on, he says with this progressive bent of the new city council, they'll start over from where they were before.
Yeah, I think if you take it that way, I think that will be a disaster, because we did make good progress. And to give Bob credit, conversations over the last several weeks progressed well. We hope to keep those conversations going.
I think everybody took this, that there was good faith negotiations going on.
There was. And I think it provides us where we ended, provides us a good starting point going into the next city council, working with the new council. And then Mayor-elect Lightfoot, I think she's reasonable enough to realize we need to find a compromise, that their original proposal not only was unreasonable, but actually will hurt the workers more than anyone, I think, really has read into yet.
Well, can you tell us where that last version, what
sure.
was in that last
sure.
version?
I think taking one step back, I think ultimately this overall issue is a solution in search of a problem. We, from the hotel's perspective, the more we've told our employees what this means for them, the more they're saying, we don't want this. We are happy with the way our schedules are set. And actually, many people join our industry because of the flexibility we offer. We actually did a survey, the broader business community. We have what's called the Work Your Way Coalition. And we did a survey of 400 workers that would be covered under these new protections. And overwhelmingly, we heard the message, we don't want this. 80% were happy with the way they get their schedules now. So it just shows you that regardless of what we ultimately land on, overwhelmingly the workers themselves, not the employers, the workers are saying, we don't want this.
But isn't there something to be said, though, for some kind of predictability?
Absolutely. And we're in agreement on that. So to go back to your question on the kind of what was in this latest version, we landed and we agreed on many of the key provisions that both labor and then, again, the employers agreed were the right thing to do. So if you show up to work and get sent home, you're entitled to some pay. You paid to take the bus or the train into work. You paid for childcare. You're entitled to something if you get sent home right away. If your shift gets canceled the morning of, you should be entitled to some pay. That's fair. If we agreed to posting our schedule 14 days out, we think that's fair. The difference is, once posted, we need some flexibility there, both on the employee and the employer side. If you look at hotels, 60% of all of our hotel rooms are booked within 14 days. So it shows you how hard it is to predict what our demand is going to be 2 weeks out. 15% of all hotel rooms are booked the day of. So 15% of all the rooms that will be stayed in tonight in Chicago will be booked today.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds very similar to some of the concerns that Sam Toya from the Restaurant Association expressed about, you know, you can't you have, while you want stability and predictability for a workforce, some businesses don't work with that kind of stable predictability.
Yeah, and what the stats I just mentioned are on a normal day. If you look at, I mean, obviously it's snowing out now, but if you look at a snowstorm that hits O'Hare, our downtown occupancy within a matter of hours crashes, but the airport hotels, their occupancy that started the day off at 55-60%, within an hour could shoot up to 100%. It shows you how flexible we have to be with reallocating staff and our employees. That's how they make a lot of their overtime and make their shifts to get 40 hours a week and make a living. Again, a lot of our employees are students or single mothers, and they need the flexibility to fit in with their schedules, and it's the way they make their living. A lot of our employees jump at the opportunity to get extra shifts in the case of added demand at the last minute.
Well, and I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, about, you know, this kind of a ordinance would affect only certain employers?
So if you look back, Bob mentioned going back to the original version of this ordinance. That ordinance, the reason I said it would be a disaster, would be the first version in the entire country. This has passed in other markets. It would be the first version that covers each and every industry. It would be a one-size-fits-all, includes every industry. That includes social services, nonprofits, healthcare, restaurants, hotels, retail. No other city or state has passed an ordinance that covers every single industry.
So this would exempt, I mean, the last version exempted.
The last version only included certain ones. And let me tell you kind of how the sausage was being made is the Work Your Way Coalition, the coalition of some of these business groups, actually put forth its own version as a compromise. And again, it included a lot of those key provisions that I mentioned we agreed to and that we think is the right thing. However, it also took into account just the way you run a business. I think a lot of the people that have been involved in the conversation, whether it's in city council or in the side conversations, have never actually had to put together a schedule and don't know these intricacies and how hard it is to account for this demand. And so our version that we put forth included the protections that we think that, frankly, workers deserve, but also take into account how it means to run a business.
We're speaking with Michael Jacobson. He's the CEO of the Illinois Hotels and Lodging Association. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune, joined here in the Allstate Skyline studio by Michael Jacobson. He's the CEO of the Illinois Hotels and Lodging Association. We're talking about the issue of workplace scheduling, an ordinance issue being considered in the Chicago City Council. Previously, we had Bob Reeder, the president of the Chicago Federation of Labor, on to represent labor's view on this, and I wanted to get Mike on to talk about the employer's view. You talked previously about things that labor employers agreed upon in this, but what didn't get agreed upon?
Yeah, there's really four key areas that we haven't reached agreement on that the business community has been fighting for. First of all, again, is what industries are included, which aren't. And I think we have a good basis in other cities that have passed this before. And let me mention also, speaking of other markets that have looked at passing this, Maine just this week unanimously voted down a version of this legislation. It shows you that there's kind of a shifting tide against passing these sort of regulations in different cities and states. So really focusing on what industries are included is a key difference for us. Secondly, you heard Bob mention earlier that we want to really protect our low-wage workers, and we couldn't agree more. I think when you hear the, quote, bad apples that are in the workplace, we want to not only identify those bad apples and punish them and make sure they're handled, but also really protect our low-wage workers, which there are in hotels, restaurants, and other industries across the city. However, the version of the ordinance, both the original and the most recent, covers all hourly workers. Hotels have workers that are making 75, 80,000, even six figures, but they're hourly. That's not a low-wage worker. So we really want to clearly define what labor means by a low-wage worker. The third is a voluntary standby list. And what that would say is if a volunteer raises their hand and says, I want to work additional hours, even if they weren't on the schedule 14 days out, if extra shifts become available, we're able to take them off of this voluntary list, and we're not penalized for doing so. That's something that we've heard over and over again as rejected from the proponents of this ordinance. And we think it's only fair to give employees the right and the ability to say, I want
more work.
Yeah, I want the extra money. I want the extra cash. That's how I make my livelihood. So why not give the employees the option to decide for themselves and work with their employer instead of having city council step in and legislate how they're scheduled?
I want to shift gears a moment, too, about kind of in the overall sense of the economic climate in Illinois, in Chicago, as far as the importance of how tourism is to economic growth mm-hmm. in the city and revenues for the state. And you were saying off air before you came on about this isn't necessarily going to be a great year after we keep hearing, you know, record levels of tourism in Chicago.
Yeah, I think if you look at tourism as a whole, it's one of not only the largest employers in the city and the state, but also one of the largest tax generators. We generate millions in city tax and state tax that go to provide city and state services. I think one of the beauties of tourism is that tourists come here. Hopefully, knock on wood, they don't use any city services. They don't call the police or fire department, but they leave their tax revenue behind and they get out of here. 2018 was a record-breaking year, both in the city and the state. 2019 is shaping up to not be, it's not going to be horrible, but it's not going to be great. We have about 200,000 less room nights when it comes to convention business this year. The reason being is several of the big conventions that are here come in and out. They rotate in other cities, and this just happens to be one of those years where we have multiple of those conventions that happen to not be in the city of Chicago. So if you look at occupancy rates in January and February, both of them are lower year on year from 2018.
And that's already a low time.
It is already a low time. So if you look at January, it was 44% and February was 55%. So it shows you that our hotels aren't the cash cows as a lot of people think they are. And as you get more and more regulation, whether it's minimum wage, whether it's the property taxes, and the expected increases we're going to see in property taxes, some of our larger downtown hotels are paying $30,000 a day in property taxes. They have to sell anywhere from 200 to 250 rooms a day just to break even, just on property taxes. And it shows you kind of the disadvantage that we have when it comes to the business climate in the city. So that's why we're worried of additional regulations like this workplace ordinance that are just going to add additional burdens and additional financial burdens on an industry that it isn't as profitable as everybody thinks.
Well, and you always hear one kind of easy source, quote unquote, for taxation is, well, go to the hotels mm-hmm. because they're tourists and take the money from the tourists. But at some point, doesn't that raise an issue of rate of return as far as people wanting to even come here?
Exactly. I think I'm glad you asked that because during the campaign, Mayor-elect Lightfoot floated the idea of increasing the hotel tax. She's since retreated.
For the arts.
Exactly.
Was her explanation.
And we worked with her and her team to really educate her on what that meant. Chicago's already one of the highest tax hotel rooms in the country. And if you're a regular traveler, business or leisure, you're not paying attention to what the tax rate is. But if you're a convention planner or a meeting planner that's looking at 3,000 rooms for four nights and the collective tax burden, and you look at markets like New York or Orlando, Orlando's 5 percentage points less in the hotel tax. That's thousands and thousands of dollars that a meeting planner, that they'll pay attention to that, and they'll choose to pick a different city as that tax rate continues to increase. So while it is a overall good idea in the minds of some, there is a breaking point, and we're worried that if we reach that breaking point as already one of the highest tax markets in the country, that people are going to start choosing to pick other cities, and that will be a shame as we talk about how important it is to our city's economy.
Well, let's just hope for tourism's sake no one is taking pictures outside
today. We're excited for spring and, most importantly, summer to come.
That's Michael Jacobson. He's CEO of the Illinois Hotels and Lodging Association. We'll be back with more right after this. Well, that's all we have time for on this week's edition of the Sunday Spin. I want to thank my guests, Democratic State Representative Mike Zalewski from Riverside, Bob Reeder, the president of the Chicago Federation of Labor, and Michael Jacobson, CEO of the Illinois Hotels and Lodging Association. Most of all, I want to thank all of you for listening. And now it's time to turn things over to Mr. Sunshine on this snowy day.
I would be the only Richards. Sunshine anyone's going to get today if that were the case.